Also, anything that you want taken out, anything if you badmouth BIM Scala BIM and you're like, I didn't need to be so harsh on those guys.
Started off by
We
bad mouthing specific
That
Scala
was gonna be my first question.
Bronte,
Yes.
who do you want? You want to get right into Dan? Vinny?
If you did, or another band, any band, if you accidentally come off the cuff a little harsh, we can retract it, is all I'm saying.
But no, I don't want you to retract anything. It's all on the record and above board. The only thing that I could say about BIMs, talk shit about them, is they were horrible dressers.
Welcome to Horn Pod, a ska podcast, a political podcast. I'm JJ Loy, and I'm joined by
Matt, inside the Beltway Wixen.
Oh, you're a creature of the Beltway?
Well, I'm actually not entirely clear on what that means. So don't hang that on me, please.
Well, Matt, you kind of scored us a big guest here, and we just got off the line with him. And
yeah, that was kind of we just had a conversation with Dickie Barrett from the Defiant, from the Mighty Mighty Bosstones. We talked to him literally like half of a day after he was on Jimmy Kimmel Live, his old job. His band performed there the night before we had this conversation, and I kind of lured him in with some politics bait, I think. And not I don't know if bait's the right word. Bait's a loaded word. But like I was like, hey, no, we actually like we want to talk about ska, but like we want to talk about it. Let's hey, why don't
we want to talk about it.
We want to talk about it.
Eyebrows.
And to be honest, like, and we did. JJ, we did. I don't know how we could have gone deeper. I'm a little bit relieved that it was like it didn't get deeper than it did.
I wanted to make sure that I like thought about him as like, oh, that he's a ska god too. Like, I want to ask him all the ska stuff that I would even if this shit wasn't hanging over us, you know.
And like, I feel like we probably could have even done more of that too. Like, we could have just done the ska interview,
right? The Let's Ignore It interview.
Like, regardless of what his name brings to mind, like it's Dickie Barrett, you guys.
I wanted to make sure I showed him that respect too. It's like, I'm not going to be like, sit here as being like, I've kept the ska show going into my 40s and I'm not going to like give respect to Dickie Barrett for what he actually did, you know? Yeah.
Like, you commanded the conversation about some like good ska stuff, and I was ready to just be like, tell me about how you got fired and how sad it was.
I was committed to not making it the only thing. So
it was very, very good instincts. And
good cop, bad
like,
cop.
when you did that, I was like, okay, this is gonna be fine. This is gonna be great.
Well, I think it does help that he is in a nut job.
Yeah, it's
I think that's the, like, I think that was the key to the secret sauce right here.
I mean, like, if I had been texting him and I was like, yeah, we're gonna have you on your show, and like we kept texting and it turned out he was insane.
When we first booked this, I was really nervous that we were just gonna give a platform to whatever nutty thought Dickie now has, but like I have to say, hearing him out, the craziest thing he fucking said was that he's voting for RFK. So like, I'm not like scared of like anything that he said. Like, I think like I said, he comes off very reasonable. It all just comes down to like one very specific issue about his body, and I can't really complain too much about that. You know, I just
all I wanted to do was present him as he actually was.
I think if anything, we've just left the door open for a Bosstones reunion for him. So if that's the worst, if that's the most spin we put on it, like, I'm so okay with that.
I don't know if that was a goal of yours. Like, why doesn't the Bosstones just play shows again? But like,
well, I partly wanted him to be like, well, they fucking hate me because I'm a dick about XX and X, you know? But
I don't think he is. It seems
right. So I feel like maybe they can get over this. Maybe this is something
right.
that some optics they can recover from, you know.
Our guest is the former singer of a band called the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, current singer of a band called the Defiant. Also was the announcer on Jimmy Kimmel Live for like a couple decades, perhaps. For my money, he's one of the best songwriters the ska scene's had. And I take that kind of thing very seriously, as I'm sure you may know. Our guest today is ska core devil himself, Dickie Barrett.
The Rascal King himself.
The Rascal King. I felt iffy about the Scott Core Devil thing. I was going to ask your permission on that.
Welcome to Hornpod.
Welcome to Hornpod.
Let me rewrite. Although your intro was nice and flattering, and I like the part about the songwriting, and let's call me the Rascal King.
Yeah.
And there's no such thing as being a former Boston. Once a Boston, it's like being a Marine. The only former Boston is no longer with us. This is
once and former
Boston, awesome, always a Boston.
I got you.
And well, other than that, thank you so much for having me on the show. What do you want to talk about? Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Let's start with Bim Scala Bim. Sorry, okay. I'm a little rascal. Perfect. I'm sorry.
Perfect segue.
Nailed it.
So yeah, I guess that's what I'm always hearing is like there's like just a handful of bands that were there kind of pre third wave that helped usher it in, and it's Boston's, of course, it's Bim Scala Bim, it's Fishbone.
Very in its infancy third wave, before it was called third wave, it was just kind of, you know, it was only a few years really after the second wave, which at that time probably wasn't being called the second wave, but the two-tone movement in England, which felt much different than what had gone on in Jamaica. And I got in through the back door on that stuff. I didn't know, you know, about the Scatolites or all that was going on in Jamaica, but I did fall in love with the English two-tone stuff. But
did you just call that ska? Was that just called ska at the time, or did you call it two-tone?
Two-tone.
You called it two-tone? Okay.
Yeah, two-tone ska. Ska music for sure. And then I quickly did my research and found out what, you know, where it was coming from and why it existed and all of that. But the point I was making is it wasn't too long after that movement. And then all of a sudden there was no Madness and there was no Specials and all of that kind of dissipated.
The beat and that, yeah.
Yeah, really kind of went away. And, you know, but there was us young guys that loved it. And early on that sort of train was definitely Bim Scala Bim. And you got to go to the Toasters down in New York. And then but there was like some other kind of, there was a band called New York Citizens down in New York and that were in there early. And then you were hearing about the, what was the band in LA?
The Untouchables?
Untouchables, yeah. I'd say that them. Fishbone was definitely then up north, Northern California, Operation Ivy.
No, wait, hold on. I've heard rumors that this is like kind of a retcon that everyone talks about Op Ivy now, but it was never really a big thing then. Did you really hear about Op Ivy back then?
Yeah.
Fuck yeah. Yes, okay. Sure. All right.
Yes. We knew they were there.
Setting the record straight.
We were well aware and the feeling was mutual. Well, that, you know, I can't speak for everybody, but I can speak for the Boston's and Operation Ivy, you know.
Hell,
but
yeah.
Did you ever gig with them? Were you ever on a show with them?
No, but we went to a very early tour. We went to Gilman Street and those guys all showed up, that whole scene. But that's what they did, was show up at Gilman Street, not because of us. And it was a fantastic show. And you could feel that something was definitely going on there. And then also there was I guess there was Bucko 9 were pretty early down in San Diego, right? Yeah.
What do you remember about the Gilman gigs?
They were out of control. That was, you know, complete. It was exactly what we wanted, which was punk meets ska.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, skanking and slam dancing and, you know, just off. We were ready for it. It was a long drive across the country. We were playing shows across the way, but we were kind of like, and you know, we'd never really even been to California. Gittleman had been to California before with Gangrene, but we hadn't. So to us, it was like landing on the moon. We're like, what is this strange place?
So you guys had kind of your own uniform. Like how was that met at Gilman, where they had kind of their own uniform?
I think it was fine. We were, you know, we looked weird wherever we went. It played even stranger when we were in LA and we played the Whiskey. Gosh, oh, I know. I remember the name of the band. We played with this band called Britannia. For no reason at all, we were just going to play the, and we're opening up for Britannia, and this is in the thick of hair metal, and that's what Britannia was, and they looked like all of those bands, Hairspray and stuff. This was Sunset Strip in its, you know, pinnacle,
right?
Time for that, and we showed up in shorts and plaid jackets and
short hair.
And hit a horn section.
Fuck yeah.
So we hit the stage and we just destroyed it. We just went fucking crazy. And the Britannia had the thick California accent, like, yo, bro, you guys, like, they don't even know what I was doing. While spraying their hair in the dressing room, getting ready to go on, and their girlfriends were all in fishnets and shit. And you guys, what do you call that music? Like, ska punk, it's ska core. Oh, it's very loud.
Okay, so even that, the whole ska core, like, were you, I mean, I know you named the record and stuff, and like, I guess Matt and I have, like, we put you into our, what we call the ska canon. And,
which of course we did. Like, if you're gonna make something called the ska canon, obviously a Boss Tones record's getting in there.
How does the ska canon work? Explain that to me.
Vote the two of us.
The two of us and whoever our guests happen to be, if we include them in it, have decided that we get to choose what albums are essential for the enjoyment of ska for all eternity in the future.
Yeah,
the stuff that defines ska, the mileposts along
it's like
the way.
If you want to know ska, you've got to listen to these records. And there's big ones, like there's obviously, like, let's face it, Turn the Radio Off. Like, these are big, but like there's also like some obscure ones from Jamaica, some obscure ones from all over the world. Like it's deep, I think. But it's also totally subjective,
arbitrary,
and based only on our tastes.
Yes, but it's an honor to be in it.
When we have discussed the Boss Tones in these segments, we talk about how early on you guys had it dialed in, just how quickly, like, the ska meets hardcore. You guys just had it, and then, I mean, like, the third wave happened, and it's just like it's all just like in your wake in a way, and you guys just had it like so right there. Like, where did it? I don't know. Where did you find that flavor? How did you know you were onto something? Can you speak to that?
I was in the Boston hardcore scene. I was part of that Boston crew, Boston Wolves, SSD Control, Gangrene, Jerry's Kids. There was about, you know, 150 kids that made it. While, you know, DC was doing Minor Threat and all their bands, and LA was doing their thing, and New York had their thing going on. We had our scene, and that's where I came from. And that was like fresh out of high school for me. I was 17 when I was first a part of that, and I was proud to be a part of it. And I loved the whole mentality of unity. But before that, I did like the punk and the ska, but that was just a kid in high school listening. Now I'm part of a scene, and all of the values and everything that scene represented, which I thought was, you know, it was about unity. It was about, you know, this is Boston coming off of busing, you know, the racial times of the 70s in Boston and torn. But this scene was, you know, speaking the exact opposite. It's like, let's unite. Let's, you know, let's get together. Come one, come all. We're, you know, so it appealed to me. And that's where I sort of got my head and my values and at a very sort of impressionable time in anybody's life, but certainly in my life at that time. So I carried that with me, and I loved the music and I loved the thing, but that whole sort of scene was short lived. And then, you know, I just wanted to combine the two things. I wanted to combine my love of ska music and my love of hardcore music, and then all of the values and everything that those two genres represented. And so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't Einstein's theory of relativity. It wasn't that difficult. It was, you know, it was chocolate and peanut butter. And I went like that. And I wasn't the first guy doing it. So, you know, I mean, it's England in 77 was fusing both of those things. It was, you know, as you well know, and I'm not giving any
to much different level though.
But yeah, I mean, there's a difference.
There was no hardcore before that. So that's right. Where, yeah, that's what the twist.
So, so you say chocolate and peanut butter, like that's just like a kind of like a natural thing. So you're just saying like, it's not a lot of thought to it. It just kind of went well together. Like it just kind of did its own.
Great things.
The message, and that two the energy.
Two of the things I loved. And the Boston's were the same way. They were, you know, kids growing up in Boston and guys growing up in, you know, that area. And we loved going to hardcore punk shows, and we loved English two-tone ska music. And eventually the stuff that started it all from Jamaica. You okay?
That goes back to one of my big my big theories is that that ska, just like from its very nature, is like meant to be blended with other genres. Like it's like
maybe it is, like, but maybe it's not. Maybe I had no right to bastardize it. But I didn't, you know, in these sort of times where, you know, there's appropriation and all of that stuff, you know, maybe I had no right to go anywhere near it. But I'm a kid and I loved it. And I'm a kid and I love hardcore music. And I knew at the time too, I wanted to be in a band. Music in Boston at that time was every night of the week. We're talking about a time when there was no internet, no video games, no, you know, cell phones, no, you didn't stay home. You went out every night, and that's what we did. So we saw live music every night. That's what we did. We hung around in Kenmore Square or in Harvard Square, and then, okay, where are we going tonight? Where are the shows? And you could hit two or three shows and you could see the same band. You know, if you saw the Outlets on Monday night, in Cambridge, you'd catch them on Friday night. There was no like, well, you can't play Boston for another 2 months. It was every night, all the time. I went to shows on Christmas night while my mother cried.
And was that how it was with the Boston's too? You guys were playing like 7 nights a week?
No, but we would do three or four shows once we got up and running.
Yeah,
it wasn't, you could play Down Under in downtown Boston and then play, you know, Bun Ratties or the Rat or, you know, whoever was going to let us go in there and trash the place.
The Boston's were very successful and successful enough to tour with Aerosmith. So I assume that you've also gotten to share stages with some old school Jamaican artists and some of the two-tone artists, probably for decades now. What kind of feedback did you hear from those kinds of musicians about like what you guys were doing?
I'm waiting to correct you. We did not tour with Aerosmith. We played a couple of shows with Aerosmith. We knew their kids. And they were really pretty nice to us. And so every year they'd have a big New Year's Eve show. And gosh, in the early 90s, they invited us to play the Boston Garden, which was, you know, all of the elements for being a Boston kid growing up. You're the Boston Garden where the Celtics and the Bruins play and Aerosmith and on New Year's Eve. And so our heads were definitely spinning. We were like, this is... And it was before any, you know, we had college radio success, which is why they asked us, but not, you know, there was Where'd You Go? Maybe Someday, I suppose. I can't remember exactly, but not a whole lot of meat on the bones. Nothing that would make us mass appeal.
Sure.
So Aerosmith, you know, and once again, it was another thing. We're up there in plaid shorts and I think I wore a plaid kilt with a you know, plaid sports coat, and we just went for it. You know, they loved us, and were good to us, and it was a thrill. So, but the question about playing with Jamaican artists, I think we played with Toots, we played with, gosh, who else? My memory fails me. So we lots.
I mean, even like some of the two-tone artists, like how did they, I mean, I assume that some of them must have encountered you. How did they receive what you kind of did with their sound?
There was no way of really knowing. And I was always so, I was always really self-aware and like, I assume they must hate us. That's what I led with all the time. We entered club, like, okay, this city hates us, so let's go for it. You know, and I would think that they, you know, if I was in madness, I would look at the Bostons and go, oh, I wonder where they got that idea from.
Right.
I was going to say, like, I could see being nervous around playing the Specials, but like madness has got to accept you, right? Like, you're right in the lineage.
The Specials absolutely accepted us. The English Beat were wonderful to us. Madness had me, if you find an album called, I think it's Complete. It's either Complete or Absolute. It's probably Complete Madness. I wrote the liner notes for Complete Madness in 1998 or so, and which was a thrill. And I also, here's a pretty good ska story. So that you may or may not have heard, but it's written in these liner notes. Gosh, not maybe 18, living in Boston, and me and my friend Patrick loved Madness, and it was, we just lived for it. Madness was my first love, and they were going to play Saturday Night Live in New York, which involved, you know, two guys with no money getting down to New York and figuring out how to get into the Madness show or into the studio, the NBC studios. And we took an overnight bus down there. So what you had to do is go down there, get in line early in the morning to get some standby tickets or tickets to the show. And we arrived there, and we were number four in line, three and four in line. And in front of us was Bucket and another ska dude, you know, like, so the four of us were standing there, but I didn't know it was Bucket or who. There wasn't even Toasters, I don't think, yet. I think
him as the guy from The Line.
The guy from The Line. English accent.
No shit. The guy from the Madness line started a label?
Yeah. That was the thing. Oh, my God. And, I was standing there like, I'm probably going to start a ska band. Oh, yeah? I'm probably going to start a ska band. Yeah. But
that's where the biopic starts.
Yeah. And we had a six-pack of beer, me and Patrick, and we couldn't drink in front of the NBC studios. So we were taking turns going down around a corner, you know, drinking a beer, then coming back, and then Patrick would go down there. I went down there on one trip and then getting back into our line. And at this time, there still wasn't much of a line, but it started to grow. And then I went down there and drank a beer, and then I noticed a New York City police officer across the street. And then I ran back to the line, and instead of going, you know, we better stop this as a police officer, I said, it's your turn, Patrick. And he went down there, and then he came around the corner with the cop holding him and stopped with his knife and made us dump out the beers and made us get out of line and said, you know, we told him we came down from Boston. We want to see, he goes, you guys go back to Port Authority bus station, get on the bus and go home. And we were like, oh my God, we're not going to see Madness now. And of course, Patrick's going, what did you do? And I go, nothing. So then we kind of hit around the corner. I think we went into a bar room and drank in there for a little bit and then went back to the line. So now we're like 40 in line, but Bucket and his pal were still number one and number two. We ended up getting into the show, to the dress rehearsal, the first taping of it. And it was a thrill. You know, we sat there, stood up. They were doing from the Keep Moving album, songs from that.
Okay.
Two songs from, and we were, you know, thrilled. We stood up, you know, like we're, the four of us ended up sitting next to each other and stood up in the back. Wah! You're like the only guys there that were there for Madness, I think, mm-hmm. or it felt that way. And then you got to, and then the show's over and the show was funny. It's, we're talking about Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo, that cast.
The greatest season.
And he goes, and so the show ended and then you get back in line for the actual taping. So now we got our tickets for the taping. Just before we're about to go in, someone comes up and goes, I'll give you $100 for any tickets, $100 for each ticket. So we're like, poor. And it's like, we've seen Madness and we go, we'll do it. And we gave our tickets to the main show for $100. We each got $100. And then we went back to that bar and watched the show live. Then yeah. we went back to the building and stood there and waited for Madness to come out. And they did come out. They came walking out. Oh my God, we're from Boston. You know, we love you guys. And Suggs said to me, do you want to come with us? And I said, where? we're going to an after party. And I was like, fuck yeah. And got in a limousine with, you know, Woody, Suggs, Topper, all, you know, the whole crew.
Holy shit.
Me and Patrick. And I don't know where Bucket was at that point. And, but found out, you know, later I found out, holy shit, that was the guy we met. I go, we met, you know, he remembered that we met. But spent the night with our $100 in our pockets, out with Madness. And they were so, so nice. And so, and just to invite two, like, you know, kids, basic kids standing in front of the building and come with them like that. Yeah. It's not going to be a problem. Guys like us was so inspirational to me and sort of how my creed and my mantra is like, no matter what, I'm going to treat people that like the Boss Tones the way Madness treated me. That was very, very, that was ingrained in that night.
Okay, real talk now. How many kids have you invited after parties since then?
Well, I don't know how many after parties I've gone to. I'm not looking for kids to invite to.
Okay, all right.
All right, so I want to read a message from a friend of mine because I was talking with him today and I wasn't going to do this, but you'll find out why in a second. He said, tell him being you, Dickie, tell him Tony from South Norwood, quote, the wrong side of the tracks, a.k.a. the flats, said Father Max forever. And I told him, I'm not going to do any of this New England nonsense. And he was like, don't. But the next thing he said was, he found me and my buddy drunk in an alley in Vegas so we could listen to a Boss Tones show we couldn't get tickets for. Sold out last minute show after Punk Rock Bowling where they played Devil's Night Out front to back. He got us in for free. But we took our time coming in and he came back like all sarcastic. You done drinking your fucking beer? I only got you in for free. Take your fucking time. Fucking so Norwood of you guys. Fuck.
All right, a couple of thoughts on that. Would only speak to another Norwoodite, Norwoodian, the way I spoke to them. I wouldn't speak most of them, but they know it's a special language that we have in that town. And he's from the flats. He's from South Norwood. And I grew up on the Tree Streets right near Father Max. And it, not that it's, you know. No, it's pretty linear. It's all, you know, there's some nice homes there and it's a great place, but it's pretty suburban bedroom community of Boston and a great place to grow up in. I love being from Norwood. But it's obvious, it's typical that his name is Tony. It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me that he was drinking in an alley. Tony cliche.
Yeah. He also, he currently plays in the band Brunovit, who I think you might be familiar with.
Oh, I know Brunovit.
With Boofish in the band.
Hell yeah.
And earlier you mentioned SS D, and I just wanted to let you know I'm going to cut this out of the episode so I don't blow up their album release, but they are working on an album right now that is called The Kids Will Have Their Ska.
Whoa.
With like a album parodying the cover of the SSD album.
That's a dangerous cover to parody these days.
I fucking told them that it looks like January 6th because it does. Yeah. And he's like, well, there's nothing I can do about it now. I'm like, look, I warned you. I did my part. I know that's not where you're coming from, but.
No. That album cover comes from a time when storming the Capitol was a good idea. Was
yeah. Cool. Kind of had a different connotation and such to it.
It did.
So let's so you've got this new band. You've got this band, The Defiant. You want to go through the roster of who's in it? Because it's hitters. You've
yes,
got
I will.
A good roster.
So there's Greg Camp, who's a terrific guy, a super talent, really, really smart songwriter. Probably will go down in history as one of the 1990s, you know, greatest songwriters, I think. Pete Parada, who played drums for The Offspring. And Face to Face, he drummed with Face to Face as well. Another really, really good guy. And it's a pleasure to, and talented. He's a beast on the drums and lucky to be working with him. Then there's my longtime friend, Johnny Rio from the Street Dogs. He's from New Hampshire and the Street Dogs are from Boston. And he cuts hair now in Houston, Texas. And then there's Joey LaRocca. Joey LaRocca, you might know from the Briggs in California, another street punk band. And he's a great songwriter and a great guy. And I was just with them yesterday. I don't know when you're airing this, but
it'll be a little bit later. But yes, you can definitely talk about what you got into last night.
April the 2nd, I was last night when we're taping this. Last night I was with them because we played Jimmy Kimmel Live. Did you see that?
I didn't see it live, but I did watch the whole episode.
Clip?
Yes.
Okay. No, the whole episode.
I watched the whole episode today.
How did you manage that?
It's you can do it. It's possible. You can watch episodes. They're on.
I don't live in that world anymore. Just clip.
Fell off a truck.
I need TikTok size clips.
See, you young people in your attention spans.
You boomers with your.
How was it being back at your old workplace?
Weird and strange, but wonderful. A lot of love. A lot of people that I've worked with were happy to see me. You know, most people. The circumstances which I left the job were unfortunate and a sign of these times. And it's not anything I planned on or really wanted to do, but was forced because of my own beliefs and values to make decisions that other people made differently. And I don't begrudge them if there's any confusion, you know, I think that people should have the right to make their own choices. And that's where I stand. And I stand firmly on that. And, you know, I made mine and I live by the consequences that have come from it. So, and on a scale of one to, you know, absolutely horrible of things that happened to people during the pandemic, you can put me at about a 3. There was, you know, lives lost and jobs lost and, you know, suicides and the alcohol, you know, alcoholism went through the roof in this country. And, you know, what was done to children with schools and lockdowns and all of that will be feeling those repercussions for years to come. And so, you know, don't cry for me. It's, you know, I lost a good job and, you know, so that's, you know, once again, I put that at about a 3. So last night, to make this answer agonizingly longer for you.
Oh, stretch it out, baby.
I returned and played, you know, Jimmy is still my friend. He was good to me for many, many years and was, you know, trying his hardest to keep me at that job. But Disney, the corporation that owns the television show and the network, felt differently. So I got to see my old friends. I got to see people that, and they were happy and they treated us great and they treated our band great. And they, you know, and our feeling on that is if you give the Defiant a platform, we'll show up and play, you know, it's not a partisan world for us. It's, you know, we all have different beliefs and different values and different, you know, thoughts, and believe it or not, we get along despite that.
And if anything, was there any pushback to you guys playing the old show?
No, not any that we felt. I think that it confused a lot of people. You know, they thought, because I think what people think of me is, you know, I mean, I support Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as a presidential candidate. And I have, and he's been good to me and he's been nice to me. And I'm not happy with the other choices at all and never have been. But I think what people think of me is that I'm some sort of QAnon, MAGA, you know, hard right dude. And I'm not, I never have been. All of the songs that you've listened to on the album that your mother bought for you,
sorry. To be clear, she bought it for her, and I just ended up with it.
You stole your mother's album.
Yes.
I haven't changed. That's what I believe in. That's what I think. That's where, you know, that's where my head was, is, and will always be. The world changed around.
From where I'm sitting, like, if the one thing people know about you that they object to is your vaccine stance, and they want to, like, extrapolate, you know, lump you in with other groups, it seems to me obvious that if you were a MAGA person, a QAnon person, a white supremacist, and you were anti-vax, there is a mainstream political party and a mainstream former president that perfectly aligns with you already, and you would have no business going to somebody like RFK Jr. It seems to me obvious that if you were a racist, you could just go with Donald Trump, and you don't seem like you're a person who has anything nice to say about Donald Trump.
If I'm a racist, are you going to paint me with that brush or tag me that way? Then I'm a diabolical one, because I spent 40 years in Boston.
Very sneaky racist.
Biding my time. Aha! I hate you. You know, so, you know, it's a tough sell, but these are the times we're living in. This is the new world order, is to, you know, you have to do that. There's not enough meat on the bones to just go, Dickie doesn't really like pharma.
I guess that's what it comes down to, is me as a skeptical bystander, I'm like, well, clearly the Bostones can't be firing this guy over a shot. Clearly this is like the last straw in something else, or this is the excuse in some other fight. Like, so that's where I've always come from, is not that, like, oh, he's some QAnon crazy. Like, this is, I'm like, well, they fucking ditched Dickie for some fucking reason, you know?
That's great. And your curiosity and your question and the way you're thinking about it is perfect. It's right on line. But the thing was, when it happened was, it was, and I don't fault them for this, and I don't fault, you know, anybody else's decisions. It was, you know, I was not in any uncertain circumstance, in no uncertain terms, was I going to get the COVID shot. I knew it was coming long before, you know, it was possible. And it was like, oh, no. I go, there's going to be a time when we're not going to be able to tour. We're not going to be able to play. And unless we get a shot for this, and I'm not going to do it. And they were like, well, that's fine. You can make your own choice, and that's fine. But as it was getting closer, now there were things like, you can't play this venue. You can't do, you know, you can't do these shows. You can't get on this plane. You can't eat in this restaurant if you don't get it. So it's more and more, you know, making them uncomfortable. What does that mean for us with Dickie, the way he is on this and on this issue? And then once, you know, I got fired from the Kimmel job, then it became, you know, now there's attention on me because I wasn't going to do anything. You know, there was, you know, why don't you get a fake vaccine card? Which there's plenty of people in punk rock and ska music that did just that. But I didn't want to signal that way. That's saying, you know, what I believe in, I'm not willing to be public. And that was a tough decision. That involved, you know, me losing that television job, which was a good job. I liked being there and very lucrative. But I couldn't send that message and say, well, I don't believe in this, but I'm going to pretend I believe in it. And then, you know, somebody else who's maybe a fence sitter goes, well, you know, I guess Dickie believes in this. So I couldn't, but I wasn't going to be the, you know, I wasn't going to shout it from the rooftops.
But it's a protest on some level.
Well, I don't think it's so much as a protest. It's just being honest. It's just being true. It's not, and they would, and it seemed to me that the powers that be were just as happy with me appearing to be vaccinated as being actually vaccinated.
Right. It seemed the way that you were describing the attitude of some of your bandmates wasn't about your opinion. It was about how your opinion looks for them.
That's the thing. They didn't sign on for that. So now all of a sudden I am the poster child. And then at the time, you know, RFK, Bobby asked me to come up with a song for him for, you know, it was a parody song of a Graham Nash song for a mandates rally, no mandates rally that he was doing in DC. And I put that song together because, you know, Kennedy asked me to do it and I'm from Boston and Irish and that's the kind of idiot I am. But no, I was, you know, honored and happy to do it. And I put that song together. So now Rolling Stone was aware of that. I was, you know, what my position was and what I was like. So now I'm getting press, you know, about it. And it wasn't great press. It was the press that they wanted to say. So it was at that point that they were like, no, I, you know, and some more than others said, no, I don't want to, I didn't sign on for this. I don't want to be a part of this. And I was saying, you know, well, you don't really have to, this is me. I'm sorry that, you know, I'm such the, you know, face and the name of this band. But it didn't, and they made their choices and they made their decisions. So that's, you know, that's it in a nutshell, I would say.
Go ahead.
And nobody in the band supported you? Nobody sides with you on this?
I think now, yes, there's members at the time, but at that time it was the eye of the whole thing. And there was so much confusion and so much fear and so much, you know, it was, you know, that was not at all a popular stance at that time. So
do you see a reconciliation on the horizon somewhere?
I see that we're still friends. I still love all the guys. I don't know, you know, the fact that what I was, you know, hoping for was them to go, well, you know, this is Dickie, you know? And so instead of believing what's being said about me, going with what's known about me and what they know about me sort of thing. But I don't know, you know, once again, it was a very difficult time and a very, you know, everything was convoluted and cloudy for a lot of people. And so that's where we end up. But will we ever play together again? I never say never. And I, you know, it depends on what's offered to me or how that comes up. And in the meantime, I'm enjoying what I'm doing.
I heard in a conversation that you had with somebody else recently on another podcast or radio show, maybe, that at the time you were let go from the Kimmel show, before you were let go from the Kimmel show, you had an antibody test because you'd had COVID already and that you tested you tested positive for antibodies, which seems to me at least as good as a vaccine would have been.
The antibodies test came from Jimmy when he realized that, you know, what my position was and what I was going to do. He's, you know, he Googled, hey, get an antibodies test. And if you have the antibodies, you've got, because I told him I had COVID, And then you know, and it says here it's just as good. And then I was going to argue, which I didn't. I think it's better. It's actually your immune system. And then I did get that test and it came back and I did have the antibodies. And but by the time I got it, Disney had come down with a mandate that said everybody that works for this company has to get the vaccine that doesn't. And then Jimmy told me that he personally would accept the test. But so that's where that story came from.
Gotcha. So like there's not even really a motivation at this point for anybody to get you vaccinated. Not that they could convince you, but like there's not like you since the vaccine came out, you haven't even really had a good excuse to get one other than employment purposes, right?
I don't, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, people did die during the mm-hmm. during the pandemic and because of COVID, but the numbers are not really what they say they are. And which is, you know, one's too many. That's the battle cry. But it was a lot of, you know, protect grandma, and it was the vulnerable. And in this country, you know, our country's health is atrocious, and the health leaders and people, you know, and you can look, you know, we can talk about Dr. Fauci, who was our health czar since the Reagan administration, you know, so his job is to keep us healthy. And I would argue he's done a horrible job at that. You know, we couldn't be less healthy. And that's nobody's doing anything to remedy that. And that was what it was targeting. And that's who we were losing. And if you talk about, you know, the elderly, well, they got old and that's what happens. But look what we did to the elderly within their lifetime. You know, this look, we took their air away from them. This, you know, I'm in LA right now. The sky behind me is it's taffy colored, you know? So toffee colored behind me. The we've polluted all the waterways. We took away food. You can't, you know, we got, you know, all kinds of preservatives and, you know, so it's in the course of a 80-year-old person's lifetime, we've fucked their health up. You know, we told them smoking was cool. We, you know, alcohol, let's go on and on. Food's not food. You know, look at the ingredients in anything. We could talk about General Farm, General Mills, or Nabisco, or Kellogg's, or any of that shit. It's just not real. So instead of like, let's try to create healthier old people, that none of that. I mean, the minute, you know, the pandemic's over and people started playing sports again, and all of a sudden I'm watching, you know, it's right back to Taco Bell commercials and, you know, drink Coca-Cola.
I've been listening to the Defiant record quite a bit the last couple of weeks. Like, it seems like the songs kind of fall into two categories. One of them is about the times, you know, modern, like there's technology, there's people's attention span. There's obviously pandemic related stuff, just general culture wars commentary. But there's also some songs that are a lot more personal. They're not about the world. They're about you, or I guess in the case of some of them, about Greg, because I think he's the sole songwriter on some of them.
He wrote Dead Language, and
I think he was credited as the sole writer on These Shoes as well.
These Shoes too, yeah, he wrote. Yeah.
So some of these, like Can't Stop Crying, seems like you must have been through some difficult emotions while a lot of this stuff was falling apart for you. And I think that Can't Stop Crying is among the songs kind of dealing with it. But like, what was it like to suddenly be kind of cast out like you were?
It was hard. I mean, it sucked. It really did. It, you know, I mean, I liked being liked, you know, and I didn't, and the world turned upside down and everything. And I'm desperately going, you know, hey, I just think people should be able to make choices in these, and I want to be able to make my choice. So, what was it like? It was, you know, I guess the best way I can describe it It sucked. It was hard and difficult. And, you know, people were piling on, and we live in a world where people have access, and there's things that I can read and things that I can hear people say, and you really can't defend it, because you start defending and it's like, you know, you start to sound like an idiot. So people that really knew me weren't piling on that like that, but people that didn't or just wanted to, you know, just like to start shit and have it for the first time in the history, all of a sudden people like that have a voice or some way to, you know, and they use it, and which is fine, I guess, and okay, and sort of the sword you live and die by, but die with, but you know, and when it's you, it hurts. So I wasn't comfortable. I wasn't cut out for it. I wasn't designed for it, you know, and in order to create and write and think the way I have my whole life required me to be more sensitive than someone from Norwood might actually be. But that was me, you know, I was
Boston doesn't prepare you for these kinds of emotions, huh?
No, it doesn't. Prepares you to, you know, punch somebody in the eyeball. But I was different. I grew up differently. I acted differently. I was, you know, I was writing, like I said, poetry and thinking about lyrics and thinking about words and thinking about, you know, what I wanted to say and thinking about injustices and, you know, and unity and love and all of the things that I've, you know, preached and taught and thought about and tried to live my life. So that, you know, culminated into, oh shit, this is not good, you know. No, you know, but you got to kind of think that, you know, the polarizing stuff and the divisive times of which we live in, you know, who benefits from that? Who, you know, when through it all, who banked and who, you know, succeeded, because while we were all at odds and, you know, pulling against each other or running into each other. And, you know, once again, it's, you know, large corporations and, you know, ka-ching.
Well, I think that, like, you got caught in obviously like part of a culture war, which to me is like, it's like the most shameless version of our partisan politics, because it's like, not only do I have to fight your politicians, I'm going to insinuate that anybody I disagree with is in the group of like those guys, where it's like, if you're a MAGA person, everybody's diverse and it's like a negative thing. Whereas if you're a Democrat, anybody who doesn't think like me must be QAnon or MAGA or whatever. And it's so tribal and so full of like the smallest bit can get you as an other nowadays. And like, everybody is desperate to push themselves away from people they disagree with for any reason. And yes, of course, I know who benefits from that. We have two corporate parties that have a lot of the same opinions on a lot of the same things. Of course, they and the donors that support those parties benefit from us pretending to hate each other over bullshit.
And with everybody immediately jumping in, well, if he's not, you know, getting the vaccine, then he must be this, this, and this. And that's the tool that they used to divide us. That's the thing, is everybody on this side does all of these things, and everybody on this side does all of these things. And I'm not either. I'm still myself. It's not enough just to hate a guy because he's not going to get a COVID shot. But pharma wants everybody to get a COVID shot. So we got to say, well, why aren't they getting a COVID shot? Because they're this, 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 and this. They're these things. Oh, okay. Now everybody can hate me.
And ignore your opinion because they dismiss you. That. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I tried to, you know, get on HornPod and say, hey, I'm not a racist, but you guys weren't around.
Well, we're here now, okay?
All right, well, let me say this. I'm not a racist.
Where were you? Sounds like somebody disappointed in some people. Someone's been let down. And the inclusion of the lyrics, "Where did you go?" makes me think that this was written kind of at your bandmates in the Boston's. Care to comment?
The Boston, closest friends that I've ever had in my life. They were, you know, we were brothers. We, you know, went through a lot together. And there was a time when I was without friends and without, you know, feeling very lonely and very desperate. Was it written about them? No, it was, I sort of always take myself out of the equation and know what the feeling is I want to write about, but then I have to kind of bird's eye view it and kind of make it more universal. Jesus Christ. Phone calls. And make it more universal. Hold on a second. Yeah.
Put us on the call. Put us on the call.
In the you made a music video for Can't Stop Crying, and the music video starts with you saying, "We wrote a ska song just for you." How important was it to include ska on the Defiant record? Because it's not very ska. It really does have like a 90s punk all-star. If you were into any of it, you're into this album kind of feel. But how important was it for you to include ska on this record?
I wrote that song with JG, John Getchess, who played keyboards for the Boston's. So I don't know. I think people would be expecting some. And I think that what we were trying, the kind of record we were trying to make was from the, you know, 1977, the era of like the new wave punk records of, you know, Joe Jackson or
Elvis Costello, I hear as well.
Elvis Costello, Pretenders, that sort of thing. So, and it wouldn't be, you know, a ska song included wouldn't be crazy or out of place. So,
yeah.
And I earned the right to write a ska song. And I've,
of course,
and that's what I did for years. And I think Boston's records work the same way too. I don't think, you know, the last one we made, When God Was Great, there's ska in there, but there's a lot of other stuff going on too.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, like, this album really, like, song to song, all of them could have been on a Boston's album if there was horns on them. Like, all of them sound like a version of, like, even when you're in, like, leaning into kind of like a Dropkick Murphys Celtic rock vibe, like, the Boston's did that as well. There's all kinds of flavors, but the Boston's had all of those flavors.
Right. I make records the same way. I mean, that's how I want to make it. And every song is allowed to be what it wants to be or feels like it should be. And we don't go, okay, we wrote this, you know, country and Western sort of, you know, blues feeling song. Now, how do we make it a Boston song? It's going to be what it wants to be. And I don't try to force anything into a corner or into a box or to fit some sort of thing. So, you know, that's just how it's always worked for me. And it's, you know, I like it that way.
Yeah.
I don't like fighting against, you know, what it naturally wants to be.
Mm-hmm. No, it's great to hear a band that's like, not, doesn't seem to have a mark they're trying to hit. They're just writing songs.
Yeah. That's what we did. And I thought we got pretty good at that. And I think a lot of people, the different, something that was afforded us with the Defiant record was that for, I think a lot of people just kind of wrote off what they thought a Boston's record was. And so, you know, I've heard Let's Face It. So everything that came after it, they just assumed it was a variation of, or, you know, the same, trying to be the same thing, and then probably not as good, which wasn't the case. You know, you go from, yeah, Pinpoints and Gin Joints was very different than The Magic of Youth, and was right up until When God Was Great. And we always worked that way, knowing we were just sort of servicing our fan base. And Boston's, you know, it was a secret that Boston's fans who actually buy the records and listen to it would know the difference and say, well, that, you know, this one's different from that one was right. There was,
yeah.
And, but most people that kind of checked out on us on that and said, well, I've heard the Boston's and that's fine with me. But with the Defiant, you couldn't sort of just check that box. You had to go, well, you know, it's not, doesn't have Boston's on the label. So what's Dickie up to? And it's kind of a nice luxury, sort of.
Yeah.
You know, in order to say it sucked, you actually had to listen to it.
Do you want to make any quick plugs before you head out?
We're going on tour. We won't be in St. Louis, and we won't be in Detroit.
Want
to make sure
you won't be robbed, probably. So everybody's in luck.
Keep your shit.
Just keep your gear. Don't come to St. Louis. Keep your gear.
So if you're one of those guys that like to rob vans, you won't be able to rob our van.
You'll have to find them in Chicago instead, or Cleveland, or
So you're gonna have to, if you're gonna have to road trip. If you're in Detroit looking to steal our shit, that's so not nice.
Hey, we're saying it, not you. We're saying it.
Guys, thank you so much.
This has been a lot of fun and an honor. And thank you so much.
Anytime. Absolutely. I hope I didn't bum you guys out.
Not at all.
Nah, man. This is actually, I was a little bit nervous. I'm like, this might be heavy. And this was actually pretty fun. This was breezy. Yeah. There's some moments, but this was great. This exceeded expectations. Thank you.
You guys are really good at this. And I've been listening to your podcast.
Oh, no way. Stop.
I have.
Look, yeah.
I don't even know if that's true, but thank you anyway. Well, hey, have a great day, have a great tour, and I will hopefully see you soon enough.
Bye, lads.
Bye. Thank you. This concludes another episode of Horn Pod. If you like this sort of thing, maybe tell your friends. Help us become the world's top ska podcast by leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, but more than anything, please just keep coming back for another episode of Horn Pod.
And I'm Matt Wixon.
And also.
And I'm here.
For Matt Wixon, I'm Matt Wixon.
Bye, thank you.
Could you thank her for buying the Boston's record? Then I will get off this weird mom questioning of you.
Yes, I will thank my mom for buying your record. Yes, absolutely.